Earth Day 2021. Good morning and welcome to you all for this special program that we have for you. Thank you for being here as always, and we will get started right away. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you. Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. I was out for a wonderful walk. It's a great day. It's beautiful. But today is a good day for me to sit back and listen to the experts that you've assembled on this program, Joe. It's really quite remarkable who you've got.
It certainly is, and we're very proud that we have all these folks and their friends, and we are very, very pleased. Judith Eng doing double duty. She'll be on tomorrow's show as well. But Judith Eng, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. Judith Eng, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Joe. Thanks for pulling together this distinguished group. I'm excited to be on with Elizabeth and Jeff.
You know, this is, I think, the third or fourth year that we have had you all together, and we are thrilled. I believe Jeff called it his Earth Day tradition, so I'm very happy about that. I know it's the 51st Earth Day, and we've only been done it for 4 years, but still, that's pretty good. It's a good chunk. Jeff Goodell is a longtime contributing editor at Rolling Stone, where he has been writing about climate change for more than a decade. His most recent book is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. In 2020, he was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, and it's always a pleasure to welcome Jeff back to the program. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Joe. I'm great. Thanks for having me. This does feel like a Earth Day tradition to me, talking with you and Elizabeth and Judith. That's how I know it's Earth Day, is we're chatting.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here as always. Elizabeth Colbert has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Sixth Extinction. Her latest book, which is just marvelous, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, came out in February and is an incredible read. Elizabeth, welcome back. Terrific to have you on the program.
Oh, Joe, thanks for having me. As Jeff and Judith said, it's like old homecoming here.
It is, and I'm just thrilled. So let's start with the news of the day, which is President Biden is committing the U.S. to having greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. He made the announcement today during a virtual summit on climate change with 40 world leaders. The target proclaims America's return to a position of leadership and urges other countries to make steep cuts. So I know both of you, both Elizabeth and Jeff, have written about this, Biden and his plans for the climate. So Elizabeth, let me begin with you of what you make of this commitment to the U.S. having greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, to having them.
Yes, having.
Yes.
Well, it was kind of an interesting whiplash day reading the headlines in the paper today. One headline was greenhouse gas emissions are set to increase again as, you know, economies emerge from COVID. And another that the Biden administration is setting these very ambitious climate goals. 2030 is really not very far from now, as everybody knows. So I guess on the one hand, you know, I would say, great, it's fantastic that the administration is being incredibly ambitious. That's absolutely the global leadership that we need. But I would feel a lot more, you know, sort of sanguine if I knew, if I saw a detailed plan for how they were going to get there.
You write in the April 12th edition of The New Yorker, the green spending Biden is proposing is contained in a $2 trillion package so sprawling that would affect just about every aspect of American life. Is it too sprawling? I mean, does that make it difficult to know exactly where the money is going to go and how we keep track of it?
Well, I think what we really don't know at this point is, you know, we don't have the legislation. We don't know. We just have this sort of proposal that lists broad categories of spending. And, you know, everyone who listens to WAMC knows that the process of actually enacting the legislation, writing the legislation and getting it through Congress, especially getting it through this very, very closely divided Senate, we really don't have a very clear idea at all of what's going to finally emerge in the final package, if there even is a final package. So all we have is this pretty broad outline at this point.
Jeff Goodell, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Betsy is absolutely right about all this. This is all, very impressive goals. Biden has certainly assembled a very impressive team at the White House. He's clearly very serious about this. You know, everyone from bringing back Gina McCarthy and John Kerry, and, he has a much broader view of climate action than even, certainly than the Obama administration had, not to mention, of course, the failures of the Republican administrations on this. And so he really sees this as, this sort of large scale transformation that is really going to be required for the climate crisis. But, we still have, a political party and a political apparatus in America that is not budging on this. And, how this ambition gets translated into actual action and it gets translated into actual legislation, as Betsy said, is really the big question at this moment.
We welcome your questions for our panel this morning, panel@wamc.org, and we will have time at the end of our hours together, both the 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock hours, to get to those questions. Judah Thank.
Well, there's no detailed roadmap on how you get to this goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 50 or 52% by 2030. So that's where it matters. And I think we'll get there. I know that history is littered with examples of aspirational goals that never get impacted or implemented, particularly on climate change. And one thing I've learned from my service in state government and federal government is the worst thing you want is a goal that's long into the distance and then no milestones, no checkpoints to see if you're actually achieving the aspirational goals and incremental steps. And it's amazing how governments make that mistake over and over again. I am optimistic here, though, because I think Biden and Kamala Harris understand the urgency of this issue. They know that we wasted the last 4 years, valuable years during the Trump administration. And they've put together a serious team. Certainly Jeff mentioned Gina McCarthy and John Kerry, but also when you look at assistant administrator level at EPA, there's a team of people who know how to get stuff done. What we still need to do is mobilize public support. We shouldn't just outsource this to the president. He can't do it alone. And there is the little problem of Congress. I think the Biden people are being unrealistic in saying that they can do a lot of this administratively and they don't need Congress. But I think, the first indicator is the infrastructure bill. There's a lot of good provisions in there to drive down greenhouse gas emissions. Chuck Schumer is so energized about electric vehicles because he also sees the job creating potential. So will we see a comprehensive infrastructure bill, and will we have legally mandated target reductions? That will tell us how real this is.
Alan, as a political scientist, to Judith's point about Congress, so how does this all go down, do you think?
Oh, not only Congress, but journalism also. We were talking on the Media Project this morning about this. And you know how how they put a box on saying 22 days till this is going to happen and
right.
That's going to happen.
Yeah.
I was thinking, wouldn't it be great to be able to say, figure out statistically how long before the Earth turns into Mars? Until it's,
tick,
until
we tick, have these tick, boom.
Until we have these deserts. And then you put a little thing in the paper, a box, or on the news saying you know, we're going to be Mars in whatever, and then you count down the days, and you make people aware every day that we're getting closer and closer to destruction for ourselves, our kids, and their kids, and their kids. So I think a lot is going to depend on journalism. Now, there was a question in there somewhere, right, Joe,
about Congress, there is what Biden wants to do and what he announced today, and how do you get it through?
Well, it's tough. You got an absolute split there. On the George Floyd thing, it looks like police reform is something that is going to get done. We're seeing that there's some movement with the Republicans. On climate change, I really want to hear from the experts as to what, you know, these people are all dependent on Donald Trump, and they see it, and they won't have integrity. What they're doing is they're saying, I'm not going to do anything that's going to spoil my political chances. And there, I'd love to hear from the experts.
You know, Judith, you brought up an interesting point that I'd like Jeff to comment on, because when you were talking about history and what we've learned over the years, you have a quote in your article in this month's Rolling Stone magazine, Jeff, which there's an incredible section in the magazine on climate crisis, which you have an article, but also an amazing interview with John Kerry, which we'll talk about in a second. But there's a quote in there that says, "We're now in a world where the past is no longer a good guide to the future," said one expert. "We have to get much better at preparing for the unexpected." And my immediate reaction to that is, oh, God, what could be more unexpected than what we're already dealing with? And I guess it isn't really all that unexpected, but still, it seems like we're being thrown a lot at once.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the ways that we talk about the climate crisis that really is kind of misguided is this constant looking for solutions and fixing. You know, there's a kind of unspoken aspect of this that, you know, the climate change is like a broken leg, that if we just, you know, go to the doctor and sit down and get a cast for 6 weeks, we'll fix this, and then we'll go back to our normal lives and we'll be okay. We can go play football again. That's not what's going on here. I mean, this is, even in the best case scenarios, we are transforming into a kind of different world. It's a different world that will not be powered by fossil fuels. It will be powered by different kinds of renewable energy. Sooner or later, that transition is absolutely going to happen. And, you know, we're going to be living in a world with different rainfall patterns, different temperatures. We are not going back to where we were. And how to prepare for that and how to think about that and how to, you know, pick the best path forward for that transition is really what we're talking about here.
One of the things that you, again, bring up is, I mean, the name of the article is Our Last Best Chance, and you make the point that the clock is ticking and there is no more room for error. Judith said, look, we basically gave up 4 years. So how do we keep the eyes on the prize then over the next 4, perhaps 8 years to work on this together?
Well, that's like that's the big question. How we mobilize, as Judith talked about, kind of political support, and not just throw this into the hands of the president and say, you know, you take care of this, Joe, and I'm going to go back to, you know, drinking my beer in the backyard. You know, I think that it's important in this notion that this is, you know, we call this piece our last best chance. It's not like, you know, if we don't do it now, the world ends. What we're talking about is trying to keep reduce the risk as much as possible. But this is not a like situation where if we don't do this, we fail. Every ton of CO2 that we prohibit from going into the atmosphere is a good thing. You know, we are making choices now about the path that we're taking forward. And I think that this, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of this sort of doomsday framing of this, you know, and I think that that's really important to stress also, that, you know, this is not it's not like we get a pass fail grade with this. It's like a decision with every ton of CO2 we put into the atmosphere of what kind of world we're building for the future.
However, you end the article It's
trying to be upbeat, Joe.
No, I know. It is, but it's a quote. It's John Podesta. Yes. And the quote is, this is it, Warren Podesta, but this really is it. If we don't amp up and accelerate the energy transformation in this decade, we're goners, really goners.
Well, I don't think he's, I don't think he means like, it means that we're going to where Alan was talking about with Mars. It doesn't mean that if we don't do it now, we're Mars. I think what he's talking about is we can abandon the idea that we're going to keep this warming below 1.5 degrees or even perhaps 2 degrees if we don't take action now. Because this really is a race against time. I mean, this is, we all know that this, transition away from fossil fuels is going to happen. There's an inevitability about that, but it needs to happen sooner rather than later. But I also think that John Podesta was talking about, the sort of political framework that we're thinking about now, that we can do this, that we can hit these goals. If we don't do it now, then these goals are we can just abandon them, when we have to think differently about this, the whole political process that we're engaged in now.
We're going to pause there. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have an amazing panel this morning. Alan and I welcoming Judith Enck, Jeff Goodell, and Elizabeth Colbert. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are going to take a news break from the BBC, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion. Many other issues to discuss. We're going to 11 o'clock this morning, and then we'll have a BBC special taking an historical look at the environmental movement in the world over the past 51 years. We'll talk about that and much more when we return after this short break.
BBC.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our Earth Day edition of the panel this morning. Judith Enck, Jeff Goodell, and Elizabeth Colbert join Alan and I as we go through and talk about these important issues with this amazing panel. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to the letters in a little bit. Panel at WAMC.org. Elizabeth, let me ask you, we've been talking about the Biden pledge and what he's talking about at this global summit this morning, and Judith touched on this, of course, about the last 4 years of the Trump administration. When you go on a world stage and you're President Biden, how do you restore trust in American leadership?
Well, I think that is extremely difficult, and there was a great quote from a Chinese minister, I think it was in the Times, where he said, they're not leaders, they're like, kids who've been playing hooky for 4 years and now they come back. So I think that they're, that was obviously also said in a strategic way. So there's a lot of diplomacy or non-diplomacy going on there, but I think that it's impossible for America's even our best allies, our closest allies, not to be skeptical of American pledges. It's, we've been in this pattern since 1992 when George H.W. Bush went to Rio and, signed the original climate framework, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and said, we're going to fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect. And we've been on this roller coaster since then, where every four, sometimes even two, sometimes we don't even wait 4 years, sometimes it's 2 years, we sort of flip around. And the Trump administration, completely, the Obama administration was slow on climate change, I think, that they would even acknowledge that now. And then finally, toward the end of the administration, really tried to make up for lost time, really was instrumental in getting a handshake with the Chinese and getting the Paris Accord. But the Paris Accord is structured the way it is because everyone knew the U.S. Senate will never pass a climate treaty. So we already sort of start out as in the doghouse here. And then the Trump administration just spent 4 years systematically, and I mean quite ruthlessly, undoing everything the Obama administration had done on the environment, not just on climate change, but very much focused on anything that had to do with climate change. And so the first thing that the Biden administration has to do, you know, before we even get to the new stuff, is undo all the stuff that the Trump administration did. So there's tons of lawsuits. The Biden administration will, you know, no longer defend the old regs that the regulations that the Trump people were trying to put in to replace the Obama administration's regulations. But that's a time-consuming and laborious process that will waste a lot of time that, as you suggested, we don't really have. So, you know, I think one of the things that motivates the Biden people here also is the sense that maybe they don't even have 4 years. Maybe they only have 2 years. You know, so right. It's a very, very difficult situation.
Judith, your thoughts on that and the back and forth.
Yeah, you know, I think Betsy is absolutely right. The United States doesn't have clean hands. And that's got to change rapidly. I mean, the top greenhouse gas emitter in the world is China at 28% and the United States at 14%. So we've got to get that relationship right, even if it means compartmentalizing issues so we can engage China and then, you know, engage our own businesses and our own state governments and local governments. And while the Trump administration, quite honestly, could not have been worse on climate change and virtually every single environmental issue, my God, I still have post-traumatic stress thinking about the environmental policies of that tenure there. I also want to point out that Democrats need to be much stronger. You know, I'm sorry to say our own local Congress member, Paul Tonko, has introduced a bill called the Clean Future Act, which includes federal tax credits to encourage the incineration of solid waste. It's as if he didn't remember what happened at the Albany Answers plant, a major environmental justice issue. When you burn garbage, if you look at the amount of energy produced in terms of what's being burned, there's more carbon emissions than when you burn coal. So what are the Democrats doing? Pushing yeah. legislation, subsidizing garbage burning. And in New York State, Governor Cuomo talks a good game on renewables and energy efficiency. But when you take out the really old large-scale hydro projects run by the New York Power Authority, which have been around for over 50 years, New York is only at 5% renewable energy. We're behind Texas. We're behind California, state of Washington, Oregon. So, you know, the climate issue needs to be tackled at every level of government. We need to pull all the levers we can. And don't assume that the Democrats are going to go to the mat on this stuff unless the public mobilizes and holds them accountable.
Jeff, let me ask you, I mean, one of the things we've been talking about just in this question about, you know, the first thing Trump did is ripped up the Paris Climate Accord. So you're trying to, right now, the Biden administration is trying to rebuild some trust in American leadership on climate change. But are we just in this, is this going to be a cycle where when you have a Republican in, they're going to rip it up, and then when you have a Democrat in, they're going to try to restore it, and it's just back and forth, back and forth?
Well, that's exactly what the, you know, people drive so much skepticism about the U.S. position on this, is this sort of constant yo-yoing that we've had ever since, you know, the beginning of these international climate agreements. And so, yeah, that's the fear. And how we evolve beyond that politically in America is really, I mean, the big question. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, one way of thinking about this is that, you know, a handful of Republicans, key Republican leaders in Congress are basically holding and are continuing to hold back global action on this. I mean, I think you could make a very strong case that if the U.S. did not have this handful of, you know, Republicans basically who have derailed action on this for decades, that the world would be, you know, much farther along in tackling this and in pushing forward these kinds of agreements. That said, there's also an argument to be made that these agreements are not everything, and that you know, there's a lot going on with, you know, for example, the price of renewable energy, solar energy and wind energy have plummeted, right, you know, in the last decade. You know, it's economically insane to build a fossil fuel plant anymore. Doesn't stop people from doing it because of subsidies and political favoritism and things like that. But there's other dynamics that are driving this transition also.
So when we look at the Judith, and I want, we have about 2 minutes before we have to go to a break. We're obviously talking, and I'll bring this back to you a couple times probably during our conversation this morning. But, you know, we're talking about the large global stage here. But you're working on this on the local level. So how do you see that play out at the local level?
Well, it's hard, but there are a lot of local volunteers working on local environmental issues, whether it's the Lafarge cement plant in southern Albany County. You know, cement production is a huge CO2 emitter. And now Lafarge has the terrible idea to burn 1 million tires a year at the cement plant across the street from a public school. So you've got a handful of very smart, talented people spending many hours of volunteer time leading the charge to try to block that. I do want to point out, in my off hours, I do lots of work with grassroots environmental organizations who have big problems on their hand. It's almost always women who are doing the work and leading the charge. And that's interesting. And that makes the meetings often go much more nicely.
I didn't know you had off hours.
Yeah, I do. When I'm not doing my day job, people find me. And it is really inspiring to see. It's when people feel like their local environment is threatened, they mobilize. And I think the challenge is, how do you get that larger than local perspective? You know, it's hard to think about, you know, the melting ice caps and how that affects sea level rise. But it's all, you know, it's all going to hit us locally sooner or later. I mean, the UN says we have just over a decade to avoid catastrophic climate change. I think there are many communities that have already experienced catastrophic climate change, whether it's Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, whether it's Hurricane Sandy, whether it's the wildfires out west. I mean, Jeff's book, The Water Will Come, profiles this issue beautifully. We are in the soup. But I think there are a lot of people that are getting involved, and it's just a matter of rolling up your sleeves and figuring out where you can have the best impact.
We're going to take a break. We'll pause there. We have a wonderful panel on this Earth Day. Judith Eng, Jeff Goodell, and Elizabeth Colbert joining Alan and I, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those when we come back, but we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to our Earth Day edition of the Roundtable panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to get in and have a question or comment for our incredible group this morning, let's go to Rick, who says, panel, I've seen several documentaries that say the claim that our agricultural practices have a much larger effect on the climate than burning of fossil fuels. If that premise is true, why are we focused nearly solely on the burning of fossil fuels? The approach to solving climate change should include all practices that are not sustainable. There are many answers to this dilemma that could be addressed simultaneously. Who would like to take that?
I would be happy to take that.
Thank you, Betsy. I appreciate it.
There is... agriculture has a big impact, but it is not bigger than the impact of burning fossil fuels. So that's, you know, just a key fact that kind of needs to be, we kind of need to as it were, agree on that.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that being said, as I say, agriculture and the estimates do vary dramatically about what proportion we're talking about, but I don't think any reputable source would say it's bigger than the effects of electricity production or transportation. When you add those together, both of which are burning fossil fuels, you get something like 3/4 of all emissions. So that being said, agriculture is big, and a lot of people are looking at agriculture is big in a couple ways, taking carbon that's in the soil and basically, you know, liberating it again. The ways that we go about modern agriculture actually doesn't sequester carbon. In many cases, it may liberate carbon from the soils, and we deforestation, cutting down a forest to plant more soy, for example, in the Amazon. That's a climate change driver, and animal agriculture, you know, the fact that cows, the way their digestive system works, they just belch out a lot of methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas that, it sounds comical, it sounds ridiculous, but it's true, and it's a big problem. So a lot of people are looking at all aspects of the agricultural system with the eye of, could we use agriculture actually to try to sequester carbon in the soil? That would be huge. Can we reduce the impacts of animal agriculture? Can we use more intense forms of agriculture so we don't need to continually put more land into agricultural production? These are huge, huge questions, and I think that, you know, they probably do deserve more attention, but I do want to assure your listeners that a lot of smart people are looking at these issues.
You write a lot about this, Betsy, in your book, Under a White Sky. I mean, it's the nature of the future, but you write a lot of what's being done when it comes to farming. And I mean, the whole premise of your book is that we're basically trying to make things better, and often we're making things worse, but it's, did I do that correctly? Does it basically?
it's not an unreasonable summary.
Yeah. But there's a lot there, isn't there, when it comes to agriculture?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot. We could be doing a much, much better job. And it does get to this point that we have, you know, just been doing things a certain way. And you do have to say our agricultural system is, on some level, miraculous. It feeds, or, you know, not everyone adequately, but it does feed almost 8 billion people now. That, you know, 50 years ago, even 60, 70 years ago, it didn't seem like that was possible. But one of the, unfortunate side effects that has come with our agricultural practices is a lot of carbon emissions.
Judith, this one's for you, I think. I have greatly reduced my plastic consumption by using toothpaste tablets, foaming hand soap tablets, household cleaning product tablets for glass and surfaces, dish soap powder, clothes, detergent tabs, and sheets, and bar shampoo. None of these are packaged in plastic. After much searching, I found a place in Cahos that recycles styrofoam on site. I recycle all I can after I've reused and repurposed. My question, with so many countries no longer taking our bulk recycling, is recycling really happening in a real way? And if not, what can be done about that?
Oh, the writer had me at shampoo bars. which they're like bars of soap, and you can have shampoo and conditioner for those who are into hair care, and avoid the plastic shampoo bottles. Recycling is pretty shaky, but important. Most of our recyclables were exported to China until recently, A real problem is waste haulers shifted to what's called single stream recycling, where you put all your recyclables in one container rather than doing even a modest amount of source separation. So you get high amounts of contamination, and it's hard to have clean source separated recyclables actually make it to companies that are going to use the material. The best example of good source separation is the bottle bill, which we have in about 8 states, including most of the WAMC listening area. Next year, by the way, is the 40th anniversary of the New York bottle bill. which makes me feel very old because that was the first bill I ever worked on.
Yep.
No one do the math to figure out how old I am. I was very young. I was an infant when I lobbied in the state legislature on that. But the bottom line on recycling is keep doing it. Paper, cardboard recycling, very, very strong. Glass, not enough strong markets. Aluminum, okay. Recycling. The big problem is plastics, where we only in the U.S. recycle 8.5% of our plastics, meaning over 90% of plastics are not actually recycled. You'd never know that if you look at the advertising by plastic companies telling us, oh, just keep buying single-use plastic and toss it in your recycling bin. Well, that is not really a good strategy. So what I do at Beyond Plastics with my colleagues is look for alternatives to plastics. It's hard. We should have more choices in supermarkets. And we don't. So we need to pass laws at the state and federal level that require more environmentally sound packaging. Because right now, plastic production is on a trajectory to massively increase. And that's mostly due to the connection between plastic production and hydrofracking. So short answer is yes, keep recycling. But only recycle number one and number two plastic because all the other plastics don't get recycled.
If you look at my Google search right now, you will see that I looked up shampoo bars.
There's a bunch of them.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. And there's mm-hmm. there's one that's called Coconut Fizz, which I'm just fascinated by. That's very cool. All right, let's go back to the letters. And we go to, oh, here's one. I'm drawn to it simply because the subject line of the email is, don't be a poop. As usual, Judith is right. We have to believe in and commit to progress. Doomsayers who complain that Biden hasn't spelled out the details, that we are likely to fail, and that we are going to suffer are giving fodder to the opposition. Climate deniers who say action is too hard, so don't try. Jeff, what say you?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, questioning the details of Biden's plan is kind of inevitable at this point. I mean, I think that's just sort of, you know, looking at this situation realistically. You know, I think that the idea that climate deniers say this is too hard is, I think most of the climate deniers that I hear don't say that it's sort of too hard. They say that they don't want to change the way that they're living, or they want to say that it's somebody else's responsibility, or that it's not really happening, or that scientists are exaggerating this, or that climate has always changed, and so why are we getting ourselves in a lather over a few percentage points of CO2 in the atmosphere and things like that. I don't think it's so much, I mean, I think it is a very difficult challenge, but I don't think that's what the sort of most of the deniers that I encounter are pushing back against. They're saying, I like my SUV, I don't want to sell it, or I don't want to get rid of it, or, you know, this is a government kind of conspiracy. I mean, we're living in a kind of post-fact world right now, and it's very difficult. This conversation has changed a lot in the last decade. You know, I mean, the kinds of climate deniers that I used to encounter 10 years ago were, you know, kind of coal industry lobbyists and things like that. And now, you know, it's much more broadly sort of spread out. And there's this sort of, you know, if you're living in a world where you think injecting bleach is going to, you know, cure you from COVID, you know, it's going to be a tough sell to talk about, you know, transforming our economy off of fossil fuels.
And it's very much led by the fossil fuel industry. You know, it was maybe 15, 20 years ago, we started hearing the phrase, you know, your personal carbon footprint. So there was a very purposeful, strategic decision by fossil fuel executives to shift this toward our personal behavior. You know, we are sinners because we drive pickup trucks and we use air conditioning on hot days. And we just have to reduce our personal carbon footprint, you know, without mentioning the role of the oil and gas industry. And we're also now seeing that on the plastics issue. I'm noticing more and more companies doing PR saying you have to reduce your personal plastic footprint. You need to, you know, bring your own reusable bag to the store, which of course you should do all that. But it's actually our personal carbon footprint and our personal plastic footprint is not going to be the game changer that we need on the climate change issue.
One more letter before we go over to a break. Joel says, although having an Earth Day once a year is good for raising consciousness and for educating people about the environment, it also creates a problem. People see it as just that, a once a year event. Every day should be an Earth Day, all 365 of them. Let's come up with another name. But then I think we'd also have to change Mother's Day and Father's Day too, right? Don't we need something like that?
Well, the good thing about Earth Day is it should prompt political action and not just be a Hallmark holiday. And in past years, it had. I mean, after the first Earth Day 51 years ago, Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yep.
It was the old days when you actually had bipartisan cooperation on the environment. So the question is, you know, can we go... I love tree plantings, but can we move beyond the tree plantings, all the greenwashing by major polluters, which is like out of control this year, and then, you know, really work on systemic change?
And Alan, I mean, what do you think changed that we got to this point?
I don't know. I just know this much. I'm sitting here feeling so guilty for all of my trespasses. You know, the Judith, every time I use a plastic anything, I think of you. I want you to know that.
So, thank you. Oh, no.
I think of you and I feel guilty, yes.
And I feel guilty. It's absolutely the case. I think all of us, you know, you are absolutely right. There are major polluters. There are minor polluters. We all have to do better, no question about that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panel this morning. It's our Earth Day edition, and we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back for another hour right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning and our Earth Day special. We have an amazing group this morning joining Alan and I. Judith Enck, Jeff Goodell, and Elizabeth Colbert. We welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We have more letters, and I want to get to those, and then we'll move on to some other topics. Let's see. We begin with this one from Jack. I take strong exception to Judith's remark about garbage burning. The trade-off is not between burning coal versus garbage, but between the carbon being put into the atmosphere by burning garbage or by letting it rot, which it will do even if you don't actively burn it. It will go into the atmosphere the same either way. And by burning it, you can at least extract some useful work from that process. The coal will stay out of the atmosphere if left in the ground. Judith.
Yeah, so thanks, Jack, but I completely disagree because you're saying the only thing you can do is compare garbage incineration to landfilling. And you're leaving out the top rungs of the solid waste hierarchy, which is most importantly waste reduction. Second, recycling of materials, and third, composting. If you compost yard waste and food waste, which is almost 40% of the municipal waste stream, you can avoid a lot of that methane generation at landfills. And you also have this wonderful soil amendment, which can be a carbon sink, as we talked about earlier. So What I hear a lot from mostly the folks promoting garbage incineration is that either you bury or you burn, but that's not the equation at all. And garbage incinerators are very polluting. There has not been a new one built in the United States for the last 25 years, except for one in Florida. And, you know, we have a bad history in the Capital District with the Albany Answers garbage incinerator. This is very much an environmental justice issue because incinerators and landfills are almost always cited in low-income communities and communities of color. New York, I think, is the second largest waste burner in the country. And we have a very polluting incinerators in Hudson Falls in Washington County and also in Poughkeepsie, both right on the Hudson River. So garbage burning is just not a solution. And it's also not economical. And that's why, as I mentioned, it's so disappointing that our local Congressmember Paul Tonko has introduced a bill to provide federal tax credits to encourage more incineration. Just does not make sense from a climate perspective or an environmental justice perspective.
I would just like to give a heads up to the National Association of Broadcasters that this year's award entry from us will include Judith Eng saying top rungs of the solid waste hierarchy.
That's how I roll.
Good stuff. Thank you for saving it for us. I appreciate it. Jason, when the huge economic benefits of changing our energy infrastructure start feeling felt, even in Republican districts, then maybe their tune will change or maybe not. Betsy, what do you think?
Well, I think that is a really good point and a hopeful point. You know, one of the big impediments to climate action is the economic interests of the current moment. And, you know, has been mentioned many times, many ways on this program, the fossil fuel industry, which, you know, has in the U.S., within the U.S., you know, we went back to becoming a major oil producer just within the last, you know, just within the time that we know that, you know, we shouldn't be pumping more oil out of the ground. So that's not a very happy thought. But there are huge economic interests in fossil fuels still, and until there is the new economy that has its own economic interests, which are in fact opposed to the interests of the fossil fuel industry, you have this asymmetry here. But the more, and you can argue there is a sort of virtuous cycle here, and that is a hopeful point and gets to the whole, you know, how we need to really move not just politically but the financial markets. If new industries are created and a lot of people have now a new interest in new industries, I do think that that will change the political conversation. Now, you know, unfortunately, there's a lag time here, and we have, for example, Jeff, I believe, is sitting in the state where it produces a lot of wind power, but nevertheless, it also produces a lot of fossil fuels, and it takes a long time. Or it will take a long time, and you could argue that precisely what the Biden administration is trying to do is hasten that process where those economic interests balance out.
And Jeff, you're in Texas now, right?
I am. I'm doing some, among other things, some reporting for a new book. And, you know, it's really interesting. I'm kind of in the belly of the fossil fuel beast here, which is feels very different than living in Saratoga Springs, where you don't run across ExxonMobil board members very often at the racetrack. I do. And, you know, a couple of things are interesting. One is that, you know, there's a lot of interest among the sort of oil gas people that I run into about, like, well, Jeff, is this climate change thing is real, or you've been talking about this for a long time, and now I think it is real, and so tell me about this. And I've joked that, you know, 10 years ago, people like that used to, when I told them I wrote about climate change, they used to, I was writing about the sex life of porcupines, you know, that it was sort of fascinating and but like trivial, kind of a cute thing to waste my time on. But now, you know, they want to have lunch with me and dinner with me and hear about what the hell's going on. And you also see, you know, ExxonMobil pushing towards, you know, carbon promising $100 billion investment in carbon capture. You have just the other day, Occidental Petroleum, which is one of the big independent oil companies here in Texas,
The CEO talked about wanting to be the Tesla of direct air capture, which is basically building machines that can pull CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is a whole other issue and problem that Betsy wrote about in her book, and is not a sort of simple solution. But nevertheless, there is this sense of transformation and change happening. Of course, the problem is, and why this Biden climate summit is so important, is that, you know, if we leave it to the oil companies, it's not going to happen fast enough. They're going to protect their interests in moving on this transition, and we need this transition to happen a whole lot faster than they would like it to happen.
Alan, anything you'd like to add or ask?
No, I'm just listening, fascinated. We've gotten a couple of letters, one from our friend Tony in New York, who says that he can't touch plastic without seeing Judith's face either.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Could I just ask a quick question? Jeff, what's your new book? What's the topic of your new book? And when's it coming out?
The new book is about heat, about extreme heat, and what the implications of that are. So sort of trying to do a similar thing as I did with sea level rise,
water.
And the water will come. Yeah. Thinking about heat. And it's really fascinating because, you know, obviously global warming is in the biggest sense about heat, but there's so much we don't understand about the implications of heat, both in our ecosystems and the oceans and things like that, but also to human bodies and to our, you know, minds, and the links between heat and violence and things like that are really interesting. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Great. I can't wait to read it.
Cool. Let's go to Jerome, who says, and whoever wants this one. Jerome says, what is Google's energy consumption as percentage of global use? And how about Bitcoin?
Well, I'll take that.
You go first, Elizabeth.
I've been talking about Bitcoin. Yeah, funny you should mention that. I will say I don't know what Google, if anyone else knows what Google's percentage of energy use is, I really don't know. And it would be a hard question to answer, because how much are we attributing to, you know, Google the company, and how much are we associating with just searches, right?
Right, which us are, using,
you know,
Google.
Server farms somewhere that are not Google's, but nevertheless are being devoted to, you know, Google searches. So I don't know the answer to that. But certainly, you know, computing is huge energy user. All the big tech companies know that. They all have these pledges to, you know, reduce their emissions and you know, buy renewable power, and they may or may not be living up to them. I don't really know that either. But Bitcoin mining, which is a very active issue right now in upstate New York, owing to a company that has bought its own power plant in the town of Torrey, and is now turning it over to mining Bitcoin. So we have a situation where Bitcoin mining is just fantastically energy intensive, and Bitcoin miners go searching for cheap power. And if that cheap power is in the form of, you know, reopening old power plants that were not really economically viable to run when they were just selling retail power or peaking power, and using them to mine Bitcoin, which is, you know, right now at least very profitable, that is going to blow a huge hole in the state's plan. So that's an issue that really, really deserves more attention.
Judith?
And this is happening in real time in New York. So cryptocurrencies use a massive amount of energy. There's some research out of Cambridge University that said Bitcoin uses more electricity than entire countries like Argentina. Okay, not little countries like the Netherlands, but as much energy is used in Argentina as a country is used for Bitcoin mining. So as Betsy mentioned, in upstate New York near Ithaca, there was a shuttered power plant, Greenwich Power Plant, closed for 7 years. It is now reopening with gas just to do Bitcoin. no environmental impact statement. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation decided to stay out of it. It's also a very political issue where you have George Pataki's former top staffer lobbying on behalf of the company. And I am quite concerned that these Bitcoin operations will blow the state's greenhouse gas emission goals singularly. So while renewable energy is really, really important, clean renewables in particular, we really want to focus on energy efficiency and energy conservation. And for a state like New York to allow this major Bitcoin mining operation to come online without a thorough environmental impact statement is really unconscionable. And this is an issue where the New York State Legislature needs to step in.
Two quick questions. Go ahead.
So for those of us who are not really where we should be on Bitcoin, could somebody give us a little bit of a tutorial on what Bitcoin mining is?
Well, I had to try to figure that out myself, and I can empathize with Alan here. Bitcoin mining is what happens is that Bitcoin is, you know, the much ballyhooed blockchain technology, which is transactions are not registered by some central authority like a bank, like when you give right. your Visa card and then it has to clear. Instead, transactions are registered by this distributed network, and people basically, miners, we'll call them miners, that's what they call themselves, compete to register the latest chunk of transactions. And the way you do that is by solving these cryptographic puzzles, which are basically random number puzzles. You have to solve these puzzles, and that requires a lot of computing power, and the more people who are involved and the more people who are competing, basically the more computing power it involves. And that's what's driving this huge energy use. These they're called mining rigs. They're basically like server farms. They're rig farms, and they just use a lot of energy to solve these puzzles and to register this latest block, for which you are then paid in Bitcoin for your participation in this blockchain. Yeah. Network. So it's quite complicated. I don't want to claim to fully understand it, but what's basically driving it is this competition and using a lot of computing power for it.
Judith, is the plant in New York up and running as of right now?
Parts of it is going to start running again soon, and then it's for the Bitcoin. They're looking at a major, major expansion, and then and that's what the local government messed up the environmental review on, and the state government would not get involved in the environmental review. And then there's a second proposal out in Western New York, in North Tonawanda. And so this is an issue. I think Betsy did a great job explaining it. It is complicated. Just think, massive computer servers using a massive amount of energy, so much so that they need their own power plant. And the State Public Service Commission won't get involved because they say it's, quote, behind the meter. So it's not generating electricity that goes out into the grid that you use at homes and businesses, but they're going to energy hog it all themselves. That's a technical term, energy hog it. That was an energy joke.
Jeff. Yeah, an energy joke. I like it. Yeah, no, it's good. I'm just wondering, like when you say like behind the grid, but I mean, if we were to do anything
behind
the meter, but if we were to like, make our own, well, let's say like our own currency, for example, you wouldn't really be able to do that because that wouldn't be like behind the bank, right? I mean, shouldn't there be regulation on all of that?
I only look at the energy side of this, not the currency side of it.
Yeah. You mean you're saying shouldn't cryptocurrencies be regulated? Well, I think that's a huge question, and Turkey, which I don't want to really necessarily hold up as a paragon of a regulatory model,
right,
just recently banned cryptocurrency. I do think that is going to become as it, you know, becomes more and more widespread. I mean, the amount of you know, value, and I use that in quotes because it's unclear, you know, the price fluctuates wildly since it's sort of on some level is a fictional commodity, but, you know, all money is a fictional thing on some level, is fantastic right now. It's trillions of dollars.
Let's go to this question from Larry, who writes, what you won't hear mentioned today, except I'm going to read this letter, is the elephant in the room, and that is overpopulation. If we exceed the carrying capacity of the planet, all the carbon credits stacked together, stacked higher than a SpaceX rocket, won't amount to a hill of beans. Reward those that limit family size with tax benefits and rebates on energy-intensive goods and services. Penalize large families with surcharges for health care, child care, and schools. Having large families should not be glorified. Who would wish to answer that question?
Oh,
or address that statement. Go ahead.
since Betsy did agriculture. You know, I do not get into those moral judgments. I do want to point out, though, that it's not just the amount of children that families have. It's also the consumption patterns of various countries. So the United States, for instance, with 4% of the world's population, uses 17% of the world's energy, gobbles up 24% of the world's natural resources, and that then not surprisingly creates 12% of the world's solid waste. So it's not just the number of children that families choose to have. Sometimes they choose, sometimes they don't. It's also how we live. Are we a sustainable society or not? So I think, you know, I think the overpopulation issue is an important one. It's also very much linked to the status of women. If women and girls feel like they have bright futures in their society, they often will choose not to have as many children if they have that choice. So it's not just a matter of scolding people for their personal choices. It's far more complex.
I will say our mutual friend Bill McKibben wrote a book on this subject called Maybe One, where he makes a case for smaller families, and I just mentioned that to the letter writer as well as to our listeners, but it's a really interesting read on that very subject. Let's go to some other letters here, and just have about a minute and a half before we go over to our break at 10:30, and that is, we go to, with Barbara, with trillions of tons of ocean waters moving in and out twice daily on an absolutely predictable and reliable schedule, why is it that we do not seem to look to tidal movement as a huge part of our energy solution? Hearing water, I will ask Jeff.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I'm not an expert in tidal power. I do know that there's been a lot of research on that, and there's a number of projects that are, you know, trying to use that energy source. I think it's very sort of site-specific, and I think the kind of questions of economics and efficiency of that are still kind of unresolved. But you know, I think that we're moving into this time when we're exploring all kinds of ideas, and you know, sort of nothing is off the table. And I think that, you know, certain places where there is a very strong tidal flow that can be exploited will do that. Same with geothermal energy. That's not the kind of energy that is usable everywhere, but places, Iceland is the obvious example, that have great capacity for that will exploit that to a greater degree. I mean, I think we're in this beginning of this age where all of these kinds of things are going to be looked at very seriously.
Couple, we just have less than a minute, so I just want to read a couple of the statements that we have that came in the letters. Elias says, make no mistake, the Republican Party's climate change denial is nothing more than a sellout. They earn millions in fossil fuel corporate donations in return for obstruction and lies. We go to Deborah in Europe. There's a saying, Europeans have no sense of distance. Americans have no sense of time. True. We don't think ahead or long term, alas. If there was ever a country that could use a good high-speed railway system, we're it. I'd be on it a lot visiting family in Chicago and the West Coast. Thank you for your letters. We welcome more. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a half hour left with our distinguished panel, and we welcome you to be a part of the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We are getting a lot of letters, so please keep them short and to the point, and we will get to as many as we can in our final moments. Alan Shartok, Judith Eng, Jeff Goodell, and Elizabeth Colbert making up the panel this morning. We welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return after news. Coming out of the seventh inning stretch of our program this morning, we'll go to 11 o'clock this morning, and then we'll be presenting a BBC special. It is a witness history program, which is called The Environment, Witness History, The Environment, and we'll be airing that at 11 o'clock this morning, and we'll take the panel right up to that point. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me just reintroduce the group to you. Alan Shartok is here with me, and we welcome Judith Eng, former EPA Regional Administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics. Jeff Goodell is longtime contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and author of the book The Water Will Come. And Elizabeth Colbert is here, has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Sixth Extinction, and the latest book, Under a White Sky. So what do you all do on Earth Day besides be on our program? Judith, I assume you have a slate.
I do. It's a busy day. It's great. So at noon, I'm going to be on Reddit, on the Ask Me Anything feature they have. At 5 o'clock, I'm speaking to a bunch of supporters of the New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. And then at 7 tonight, I will be speaking at an event organized by Williams College on plastic pollution. That's on Zoom. So folks can go to the Williams College website and get the Zoom link. It's free. I'm very grateful for Williams College hosting me. And I will touch on the climate change, the environmental justice, the health, and the ocean element of the plastic pollution issue. And then in between, I'll do some work.
Betsy, you have any book events or anything?
Well, no. And I always really like to try to go for a hike on Earth Day. It seems like the really most appropriate thing to do, but the weather, as everyone in your listening area knows, is not very conducive. I see snow falling outside, so I'm not sure there'll be an Earth Day hike today, but I do plan to listen to Judith tonight at 7 p.m.
Excellent. Jeff, you got anything going on?
You know, it's kind of a big work day for me. You know, I've got to try to make sense. I've been listening to Biden's climate summit, trying to make sense about what's going on there, and probably we'll write about that this afternoon. And then just trying to get, you know, some work done before. I also listen to Judith tonight.
Excellent.
No need. I do want to.
You sent me the speech. I feel. I'm good. I got a sneak preview of it. That's good.
You don't need to attend. Right. I do want to mention that in addition to Betsy's book, which is remarkable on kind of the cutting edge issues around climate, Jeff has a series that you can find on the Rolling Stone website. You know, pretty pointed debates like the future of natural gas and direct air capture. I watched some of it, not all of it. I will add, it's beautifully video produced. And it's just really interesting to hear the different perspectives, the industry perspectives, the environmental voices. And those details are really going to matter. So here's a shameless pitch to go to the Rolling Stone website and just watch a couple of those at your leisure.
Well, I also have to say, you also on Jeff's website, you have all these interviews that you've done, Jeff, even just over the past year, but with Bill Gates, You even did one with Betsy. Also Dr. Fauci and talking to Gina McCarthy, who is in the news today as well, which I think are really, those are fascinating interviews. And as I said in the latest edition, there is the interview with John Kerry, which is really special as well. When we talk about Gina McCarthy, I know this is your former boss, Judith. The New York Times article today, Biden is pushing a climate agenda. Gina McCarthy has to make it stick. So talk a little bit about her, Barack Obama's EPA chief, and what the last 4 years have been like for her and what position she's in now.
Yeah, well, she's the woman of the hour, and she can make it stick. I mean, she is a very effective former state regulator. She headed up the Connecticut Environmental Agency. I got to know her through the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, a regional attempt to do cap and trade on carbon emissions a long time ago. Her first 4 years at EPA, she was the assistant administrator for air. She really dug deep on air pollution, climate issues. And then after the amazing Lisa Jackson left EPA and went to work at Apple, deeply admire Lisa, Gina was the EPA administrator. She really knows what she's doing. During the Trump years, she was at Harvard tackling climate change and public health issues. She works really hard. She's tenacious. She brings people together without losing her focus on her goal. She also has the best Boston accent you will ever hear. and she's going to get it done. I have no doubt she will work harder than anyone, and then she will partner with Kerry on, he is going around the world using soft diplomacy to convince countries to get serious about greenhouse gas reduction emissions. So if anyone can do it, it's Gina.
Jeff, you interviewed her prior to the election, and I'm just curious of what your takeaway was.
Well, I mean, you know, people always ask, you know, what gives you hope? And I think that's a complicated question. But one of the things that gives me hope is Gina. I mean, Gina is just an awesome human being, first of all, and also just incredibly savvy about how political system works and is incredibly committed to this. And, you know, I mean, she's only one person in you know, this sort of global movement. But, we talked a little bit at the beginning of the show about the strength of Biden's team. And you know, John Kerry, who I went to China with a few years ago when he was trying to bring China into the Paris Climate Agreement, he is also extraordinarily committed. And, you know, I think as Betsy talked about in the beginning, one of the things that needs to happen here is how, big question, is how America's trust gets restored and how, you know, how we regain any kind of leadership. And I think that people like Gina and John Kerry and many others in the administration have this reserve of trust among leaders around the world. And I think that's going to come into play right now to the degree that America can their word can be taken again on this. And I think that cannot be sort of overstated how important that is.
We'll go back to the letters, and John writes, more people should leave the car in the garage and ride bicycles. The carbon footprint of a bicycle is minuscule compared to even an electric car. Maria says, Alan often says what I'm thinking. He puts words to my thoughts. He's got the best take on things. For that, I appreciate his opinions and comments invaluably. Would you like to comment on that, Alan?
Yes. First of all, thank you. But I have to say, you know, sitting here listening to the people who have been invested in this topic and everything that they've done is tiring. It's fatiguing. I'm tired just thinking of what you guys have done.
A lot of great work.
It's just amazing. And to you, Joe, You know, all I did was to help build a radio station. but I did hire you, and you are doing such a good job with this that I'm leaning back and saying, this is terrific.
Well, thank you. And thank you for hiring me, by the way. I appreciate it. It's been 26 years, and I'd say it's a pretty good run. Let me get to this question. Erica says, with the legalization of weed in many states, how's our CO2 looking? Who wants to take that one?
Well, see, weed is not unlike Bitcoin mining, unfortunately. It's turned out to be a very energy-intensive process. I don't know what New York law is. I can tell you in Massachusetts you can grow your own weed for personal consumption in your backyard, and that's a lot more environmentally sound. How's that?
Yeah, I think the New York law is 6 plants or something. Yeah, but go ahead.
And as you know, Betsy, they are everybody. The small towns are making out like bandits as a result of all the marijuana stuff. I believe we have 5 marijuana dispensaries in Great Barrington. But the big stories now are they want to grow it here. And boards of selectmen are looking at the money and then looking at whether this is going to foul things up. And there are a lot of complaints about the smell and the this and the that of the whole thing. So,
from an environmental standpoint, maybe not from a local political standpoint, but growing things outdoors is always going to be more ecologically sound than growing them indoors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the New York statute sort of punted on the environmental issues and gave a directive to this new state agency, and it tells them to look at the energy consumption of the growing, and also, I was trying to get some language in not having plastic packaging, because this is going to be a whole new universe of plastic waste on streets and beaches. But the state bill basically just directed the new agency to look at environmentally sound packaging choices.
Not to belabor the point before a break, but when they say look at it, are they going to be looking at it after they've already done it initially, or do they look at it before it's actually implemented?
I don't know. Good question.
All right. We'll leave that hanging in the air. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll have our final moments with our panel this morning. And we welcome your letters. Last call, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Quick programming note, coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, we will be airing a BBC special. It's part of their Witness History series, and it is a program entitled Witness History, the Environment, where we will hear remarkable stories of the history of the environmental movement told by people who were there. And we will be broadcasting that beginning in just about 15 minutes. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. I just want to go around the room for a second because we've been talking about a lot of stuff today, and a lot of it has been things that are in the news and things that you all have been writing about and working on, and of course, listener letters. I would like to just ask all of you to think if there is an issue that is something that you think we're missing this morning that we should talk about that perhaps is not on our radar that should be. And I don't know who would like to start on that, I want to give everyone time to think for a moment, but just of issues that should be that we're not talking about. One of our listeners who was talking about overpopulation referred to it as the elephant in the room. Are there other elephants in the room that we should be talking about this morning? Betsy, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, I think the one of the big elephants in the room, and it's the flip side, as Judith said when she talked about, population, there are really only a couple of factors that determine our ecological footprint on planet Earth, and that basically goes for climate change, which is one manifestation of that, and that is how many of us there are and how much how much we're consuming. So population is one part of the equation, and in a lot of the developed world, actually, population growth has basically flattened out. So basically, populations are flat, and it tends to be in parts of the world where people are very low consuming, where population is still growing. So the flip side of it is we in the developed world, we really need to look at our consumption habits in a very, very profound way. And, you know, one of the questions going forward with climate change, and I do really, really think it is the elephant in the room, is or an elephant. I guess there's a lot of elephants in this room. Can we continue to basically, you know, live the way we live, just say, well, we'll just flip out, you know, for all the fossil fuels that we have, we'll just substitute in, you know, some form of renewable power? Or do we really need to look a lot more fundamentally at our consumption patterns and sort of recognize, well, you can't have, you know, there was a famous Kenneth Boulding, an economist who made a big splash in the 70s, it's sort of time to bring this thinking back, I think. Has a wonderful quote, the only people who think you can have infinite growth on a finite planet are madmen and economists. And, you know, that kind of thinking, I think, does still continue, and I think it's probably time to once again reexamine that.
I think after my lifetime of asking people questions, I don't think I've ever got to ask this one, and I'm really looking forward to it. So, Jeff, what is your elephant?
I'm glad we're friends. Otherwise, I might take a little offense at that kind of blunt question. I have two elephants. Yeah, one nice, one not so nice. The sort of nice elephant that I think is not talked about enough, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, is this question of innovation and to what degree, you know, we're going to see, you know, changes, you know, with energy production, cheaper solar. What happens when these prices of renewable energy continue to decline? You know, how quickly will developing nations and stuff change? You know, it cuts both ways with the Bitcoin question also, which is, you know, taking us in another direction of unexpected increases of fossil fuel emissions potentially. But the sort of not so nice elephant in the room that I think we don't talk about enough is the relationship between climate change and disease, which, you know, is something obviously on one level is on our minds now because of the COVID pandemic and things. But I think that, you know, as our planet warms up, you know, animals are moving around in different ways. And as we continue deforestation and things like that in places like the Amazon and other places, we have animals moving out of habitats, and those animals often carry pathogens that are not sort of really nice to human beings. Dr. Fauci talked about the beginning of a kind of new pandemic era, and that is something that I think that we have not really begin to bend our mind around in a way that could have, and it could have obviously enormous impacts on our future.
And Judith.
Well, I think it's urgent to get big money out of government decision making. The science on climate change has been clear for decades. You know, the science on deforestation, on the need for clean water, on the need to not have our oceans filled up with plastics. The list goes on and on. The problem is the death grip that special interests have on decision making. And in two ways. One is they have a fleet of lobbyists in state capitals and in Congress that really peddle misinformation on a regular basis. And then they give massive campaign contributions. It's not a fair fight. I mean, it's amazing we get anything done. And I think we need greater transparency in government decision making. We've got to pull the curtain back and let the public know how decisions are being made. We need campaign finance reform. We need to look at how judges are selected. We need to update, you know, we need democracy 2.0 if we're going to tackle these issues in a substantial way.
Mm-hmm. Alan, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. The elephant in the room for me is the political elephant. We're about to have, and I think Judith was touching on it, we are about to have off-year elections, so 22.
Right.
And the Congress could go the wrong way, in my opinion. It could be that we're going to have Republicans take the Senate and the House of Representatives, and the way that they're cheating now and loading the game is this is not relevant to this particular discussion. However, the environmental community has to be very, very careful about what they're saying and doing and positing so that there isn't a reaction to it on the part of some. I mean, farmers, for example, and others. It has to be done thoughtfully because the loss of the Senate and the House could be terrifying.
Mm. You know, we just have a few minutes, 3 minutes left, actually, and I want to just say it's interesting to me because, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, we've had this group together for many years, and we've talked about these issues, and I've always sort of asked the question, and even Jeff alluded to it earlier, of you know, saying trying to be optimistic. Even Betsy's new book is, you know, there's a lot of really scary stuff in there, but it does have its share of optimism. And I guess that is sort of where I'd like to leave us this morning, is that people can feel that they have a stake in this, they can do something, and that they can come away not just from this program, but from Earth Day 2021 and feel somewhat optimistic about the future. Betsy?
Well, I mean, here we are meeting on a day, and it's obviously no coincidence that it's Earth Day, where, you know, the new president of the United States is convening a meeting of world leaders, as Jeff and Judith have pointed out. Biden has assembled a really, really talented and committed group of people to deal with climate change. That, you know, is not an accident. That reflects the energy behind a pretty, you know, increasingly powerful, I think, political movement. And I give young people a lot of credit for that, for really pushing Joe Biden, who I don't think began his, you know, political career as a big environmentalist. So I think that is a reason for optimism, you know, that we're getting movement and it is in the right direction. You know, as Alan dolefully but accurately pointed out, you know, that is, you know, already threatened potentially 18 months from now. But Let us enjoy right now, today, on Earth Day 2021, that things seem, the political momentum, at least for now, seems to be going in the right direction.
Jeff, we've got about 90 seconds, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just amplify what Betsy said, which I completely concur with. You know, what gives me a lot of hope and optimism at this moment is the fact that, you know, everything is up for grabs. We're at this moment when it's become clear that we are going to sort of reinvent our world in a very profound way, not just about, you know, SUVs versus bicycles, but how we fly, how we live, how we eat, all kinds of things. And it's not like our world as we've lived in it has been perfect. And there's a lot of things that can get a lot better. And if we're intelligent about how we think about this and the political choices we make, we can make a much better world. And that is a very optimistic feeling.
Judith, we have about half a minute.
Yeah, we're at an inflection point, and everyone should jump in. Don't assume that someone else, an elected official, a business, is going to take care of it. We all can do something.
All right. I want to take our last moment here just to thank our wonderful panel this morning. Judith Eng, environmental, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics. Thank you, Judith, as always. Jeff Goodell, longtime contributing editor at Rolling Stone, author of The Water Will Come. Jeff, thank you. It's always great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's great to talk with you.
And Betsy, a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, and her new book, Under a White Sky. Betsy, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure to be here.
A great pleasure to have all of you together. Alan, of course, thank you very much. Great to have you at the helm. Thank you, sir.
You are terrific for what you've done here, Joe. Thank you.
Well, we'll be back tomorrow. Judith, you'll be back tomorrow, too.
Yep.
Have yesterday's guest, David Soares, with us, and we'll have another guest by the name of Rosemary Armeo. Yeah, you heard me right. Okay.
Yay.
All of that on tomorrow's program. I want to remind you that coming up next, BBC's Witness History program
Witness History, The Environment is coming up next. A reminder, all of our segments are available online, wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. Stay tuned now for BBC.